Travel presented by Vintage Guitar Magazine with your host, me, James Patrick Regan, otherwise known as Jimmy from the Deadlies. And today I'm speaking with guitarist Joel Hoekstra. In our conversation, Joel describes living in New York City and growing up in the suburbs of Chicago with his parents, who were both classical musicians. And Joel tells us why he didn't pursue piano. Joel describes the impact of seeing AC/DC on MTV as a kid, which slowed his sports interest. And Joel describes his gear starting on his stepmom's guitar, and he discusses his guitars from then on, and how he got the collecting bug, and he discusses his custom Gibsons and Jacksons, and the guitars he uses for each of his gigs. Joel tells us about his first bands, through his gigs with Trans-Siberian Orchestra, Whitesnake, Night Ranger, Jim Petterick, and Cher, as well as his time spent as a pit guitarist for Broadway shows like Rock of Ages and Love Janice. Joel talks about using in-ear monitors and hearing loss, and Joel talks about his time at GIT in Hollywood and working at Cherokee Studio. Joel discusses his new album, From the Fade, and the personnel on the album, and the chances for a tour, and he describes the other projects he's working on, Revolution Saints, Hoekstra Gives, Teaching Remote Lessons, Broadway's Rock of Ages band, and Iconic, which includes a lot of his former Whitesnake bandmates, as well as his time spent producing other artists. Finally, Joel tells us about what he does when he's not playing guitars, his kids, and anything to escape music, and his plans to go to NAMM next week. To find out more about Joel, you can go to his website, Joel Hoekstra. .com. That's JoelHoekstra.com. Please subscribe, like, comment, share, and most of all, review this podcast. I'd really appreciate it. And please support Vintage Guitar Magazine for all the wonderful things they do for us guitar players, because they do so many wonderful things for us guitar players. Here's my friend Joel. How are you, Joel?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
No, the pleasure's all mine. Are you based in New York City?
Yeah, Upper West Side.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
All right. Have you lived there all your life?
No, but I've been here a while. I'd say 25 years now, something like that. So long enough to kind of be a New Yorker, but, you know, Midwestern roots. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago.
Okay. Right on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And your parents were musical?
Yeah, they're classical musicians.
And how do they feel about you pursuing the hard rock bug?
I think they're probably overall glad about it. And I think initially probably like, don't go into music, because they spent their lives in classical music and just were a little concerned, as most parents would be, about their kids saying they want to be a professional guitar player.
It's
a tougher road to go, no question. You know, you gotta fight through that window. I feel like you have to commit to being poor the rest of your life, and then if anything good does happen, you're cool, you know. So that mentally, that's understandable, but I think part of them probably wished one of their kids went for classical music, you know.
Uh-huh.
You put two classical musicians together and they're probably hoping one of their kids turns out to be a classical prodigy, but wasn't in the cards. Here I am.
But quite successful. Do you have brothers and sisters?
I have an older sister, yeah.
And does she play?
She does play piano still a bit. That was part of my reason of not liking piano and cello when I was younger, is my sister kind of kicked my ass on piano being older. And so it was just kind of like a humiliating process on a daily or nightly basis, practicing and hearing her just destroy me. So I think especially at that point in time, I was really young and just kind of really into like baseball, and that was my initial love in life, was to be a baseball pitcher. And
uh-huh.
I was just doing nothing but playing baseball, playing Little League and stuff like that. And then Back in Black came along and changed all that.
Uh-huh.
Which kind of coincided with that time period where all the boys had their growth spurt before me.
Uh-huh.
And I started to get my ass kicked as a pitcher, so I was out there throwing, and all of a sudden people weren't swinging and missing anymore. They're hitting the pitches, and I was going, man, I need something else. And it just was perfect timing, you know, the guitar and music, and in particular AC/DC Back in Black was kind of what lit the fuse, seeing Angus Young and all his not necessarily at that time. I didn't really understand the intricacies of the playing. I was just a young kid.
Yeah.
But it was the energy. It was like seeing him on MTV when it was first out.
Yeah.
So barely any videos in rotation, but seeing Angus on there and just how electric he was.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
As a kid, that's super appealing. You see that and you go, well, that's the coolest adult I've ever seen in my life. I want to be that guy.
Yeah, well, in high school, did you play in, you know, the varsity teams and stuff like that as far as baseball?
No. So sports fell away for me really early because I think guitar started at like 11. So I want to say I pretty much stopped playing baseball maybe somewhere right around in there, 11, 12 years old.
Yep.
So this is, I'm talking way, way back.
Yeah, yeah.
And then so finding rock at that point in time, that was the first time I had liked any music on my own where I'd said, I like this.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess where I realized music could be cool.
Mm-hmm.
I, up until then, it was kind of this discipline. It almost felt like schoolwork doing the classical stuff.
Sure. Especially having musical parents.
Which oddly enough, I mean, I kept as part of my situation when I became involved in the, you know, playing rock guitar and joining my first band. My initial 2 years out of high school and even the end of high school were spent studying classical guitar too. So
wow.
I did put in a few years, even I guess slightly more evolved. I can't even say adult, but like older teenager,
yeah.
Where I dedicated a lot of time to that as well. So it still was in the mix.
Yeah. Was your first guitar a nylon string?
So I had to start on my stepmom's acoustic, which I don't even remember the brand. And I had a teacher that was teaching me out of the Alfred's Method book.
Yeah, of course.
And he was showing me the three notes on the high E and everything like that. And man, I didn't like it. I was in the room and I was going, this isn't what I pictured. How do I get to be Angus Young? And at that age and being that era of what we had in terms of exposure to our heroes, they just seem like magical deities.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so like something that was unattainable.
Yeah.
Like, well, there's no way I'll ever be able to do that. But I went over to my friend's house and he had an electric guitar.
Okay.
And he pulled it out and he started playing rock riffs and my brain exploded.
Yeah.
I think he played the riff from Crazy Train, if I remember correctly. Okay. And my brain just kind of went like, oh my God, how do you know how to do this? And he said, oh, you got to go to my teacher, man. He teaches rock stuff. And so I went to him, and he taught me Paranoid on my first lesson. And from there, it was like obsession. The obsession began. And he talked my parents into getting me an electric. He said, yeah, you got to get him an electric for him to be inspired. And he was good call. Got it. Next thing. Yeah.
What was the electric?
I still had to prove my so I had an Electra Westone out of the mall store.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and that's where I was taken in a mall.
Yeah.
It's classic suburban type of situation. And I think the body style, you know, I don't even know the model on that particular guitar, but the red and the contours, I think, reminded me of Angus's SG.
Sure, sure, sure.
So I had this Electra where I was really young.
Yeah.
And I just went, that one looks cool.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I started on that. And then after a couple of years, unfortunately, sold that guitar to get my second guitar, which I think my big complaint at the time being this, I'm going to say this is probably about like 85 or something like that. I needed a Floyd Rose. Everybody was doing the Floyd Rose thing.
Yep.
So my teacher at the time, who turned out to make a name for himself a bit with the with guitar, TJ Helmrich, he was getting rid of his Kramer Beretta.
Oh, wow.
Single EMG.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, the Floyd Rose. So I ended up getting that, buying that from him and selling the Electra Westone.
Okay.
And from there, the collecting began because I never let go of the Kramer Beretta. That still exists.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I still have that. And that's something I spent a lot of time on when I was a younger guy. So
yeah,
there's...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I wish I had the Electra Westone too, really.
They're out there. Yeah, I'm sure you could find one.
Yeah, but I would want the one.
And so as far as playing in bands, were you playing in bands in high school?
The first complete band that I joined, I was 15, and that was pretty much the time of my first gig.
Okay.
I had a lot of trouble. I switched high schools in the middle.
Uh-huh.
So my freshman and sophomore year of that particular school, I was able to get together with like drummers mainly. I would jam with drummers.
Sure, yeah, of
get
course.
Together and play with them,
yeah.
And run tunes and
yeah.
Or just jam, whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then when I went to my second high school, a band kind of fell into place a little bit easier. They kind of had it together, I think, and wanted a guitarist.
Yeah.
And it was funny because I didn't fit the bill image wise, I had short hair still, and I had still was like, I was very short going into high school. I was like 5'4".
Oh, wow.
And I think even at the time of joining that band was still pretty short, maybe 5'8", something okay. like that. So I was this shorter guy with short hair, looked very young still. Uh-huh. And it's a little bit like, you know, the Almost Famous thing where you're looking in the mirror and everybody, all the guys in the band had the long hair and the image. And I was kind of this dork that they had in there because I could play.
Yeah. And what were you using for, as far as an amp back then?
Terrible stuff. I had the worst choices of tone and gear as a younger man. I started out, let's see, with a Crate practice amp when my parents did buy me an amp.
Okay.
The first thing was technically our home stereo. I plugged into the auxiliary input. That same teacher, the cool guy who said get him an electric guitar, he told me the trick of plugging into the auxiliary input of your home stereo and just put that thing on 10 and go. and drive the neighborhood crazy. And so then the Crate practice amp, and then I had this, like, I'm going to get this Marshall half stack, but for some reason made a poor decision and went with one of the little GK 250 ML heads.
Yes.
And I plugged that into a Fender 412. Okay. It was up at a big store in the Chicago area at that time called DJ's.
Okay.
And they sold me the, I had a friend who was in a good local band sell that to me. So I had this GK. I used to push it, I think, with a Boss Graphic EQ to make it grind a little bit more than the GK would. But terrible, awful tone. I mean, I have stuff from us back in the studio. And then I was over at another friend's house who had gotten a Roland GP8, which is probably the equivalent of like the early modeling stuff. Yes. I mean, it was just like a rack unit with just, you know, not good. Yeah. And but I had the choice of buying that and running it into the front end of my GK and the Fender 412. And this was the ugliness of the story of my tone as a kid. Plugging the Kramer Beretta into the GK, into the Fender 412. Yeah, that's pretty much it. And the Roland GP8 into it. I mean, it was like, not pretty. Like a lot of my early four-track recordings, this is like me living there. Even when I went to GIT, which I did when I was 19 years old, I spent a lot of that time in my apartment in Hollywood, just like recording back when you'd have the drum machine, which also sucked. I had a terrible drum machine. I had a terrible drum machine, terrible tone, but I still have the recordings of that stuff, and it's really fun to listen to. I kind of, during COVID, I took advantage of a lot of that downtime to move it into the digital domain, get it off of there, and get that stuff into my, like, at least have some kind of rough mix of it in my iTunes or whatnot, and have access to it. So, I mean, bad stuff, and I had a Rockman that I also had that I would practice with. So those, that's kind of the early gear choices.
And when you went to GIT, had you ever been to LA before?
No. So yeah, I went there. I wanted to go straight out of high school. I knew TJ Helmrich was going to go there. He was my second guitar teacher. So the cool guy, couple of us got a little advanced. We were playing solos and we wanted to learn. Back then, the teacher would have to transcribe it on cassette and toggle and write it out for you or just show it to you. This is even kind of right at the advent of tab, believe it or not. Like that first teacher, he didn't even tab the stuff for me, man. Like when people talk about how old school it was like I had to practice it immediately upon leaving the lesson. Otherwise, it was gone.
Gone forever.
So you just threw away your $10 or whatever you paid for the lesson, right? Now I'm talking some serious dinosaur action here, man. But anyway, TJ would transcribe the stuff. Like I remember learning the solo from Crazy Train from him and stuff, and him transcribing that or showing it to me. I don't even think he was necessarily tapping that at the time. I think he just showed it to me. But yeah, I'd say that was kind of the way that stuff started. And then I had the classical stuff going on, and there was a local teacher who had gone to GIT. Zach Mischer, and he had the GIT curriculum kind of going and in his basement.
Okay.
So I ended up studying a lot of the curriculum before I went. But I was really eager to go to GIT. I knew that was what I wanted to do because TJ was going there, and he was not only a teacher, but we kind of became like friends.
Yeah.
And we'd get together on the outside and jam. And so Yeah, he went out there and he was really quite proficient with the eight finger thing at a young age, and landed a job teaching that there.
Okay.
Because he had kind of had found his specialty.
Yeah.
And so he was a teacher there. And so by the time I was 19, that's when I finally got my parents to say, yeah, that seems like a reasonable age to let you go out to Hollywood. And I mean, realistically, it was all kind of insane looking back on it. But I don't regret any of it. It was a great learning experience going out there, great period of my life.
Sure.
It's funny. It's funny how things worked out. I've had a really nice career, great career, whatever you want to look at or call it. It's all relative, I suppose. But it's the naivete happening back then is just like irreplaceable, and I would probably trade it all to go back to that place and time again, just to have that feeling of you don't know what your life is going to be at that age. It felt like it being in Hollywood at that age, that the ceiling was high and it was fun.
Yeah. And so was it the end of the hair bands when you were there, or was it a mid hair band?
Yeah, so what happened is I graduated from GIT, and then TJ was by then working as a tech at Cherokee Studios, which is a 5-room place, legendary studio in LA.
Yeah.
So he made the recommendation to get me in as like a runner to start, and I trained and I worked up into the tech department pretty quickly, maybe a matter of 2-3 months. And then was in that tech department out there for, I'd say, maybe another 9 months. So I was in LA for like 2 years, and then it got really sketchy. The Rodney King riots happened and everything like that. And it just felt like a little chaotic. And I wasn't playing much guitar. I was like riding. I didn't even have a car. I was like riding my bike back and forth to Cherokee, making minimum wage, practicing. And I just thought, you know, this seems kind of fruitless. Like, I just need to, all I really want to do is play guitar.
Yeah.
So I kind of opted at that point in time to go back to the Chicago suburbs. And I took on a roster of like 70 students a week, just started teaching my ass off and gigging on weekends in bars. And those gigs just kind of gradually grew better and better. And I have obviously a very long, complicated story. You'd have a 10-page article on me if we put it in print on like the logistics of it, how it all like worked out. But
just logistics of 70 students alone is pretty rough.
They were 30 minutes back to back. So, I mean, I could cancel whenever I had a gig. Yeah. To me, it made solid sense. And at that point in time, I was at least like paying my bills, had my own place, and it was doing it all with guitar. And so that was at a very young age, 20, 21, 22 years old.
Yeah.
So not a bad situation to be in, at least. I mean, there was definitely that entire period from that age all the way through having things kind of break open for me, which happened really late, of just kind of being the family loser. Like, this guy's, you know, like the poor guy who didn't get married and doesn't have his own condo and that kind of stuff. And anyway, yeah, I mean, in the end, everything worked out great. But that's what I mean. You have to kind of commit to poverty. You have to commit to that moment of being like the black sheep of the family and all that stuff.
Yeah. Was it when you were choosing GIT, I know you had a friend there, but was there any thought of going to Berkeley instead?
Yeah, there was some there with that. I think it was mainly TJ going out there that motivated me into that. I think he probably swayed me in that direction, probably more than anything else. I mean, the Berkeley thing would have been great. That would have been another thing I wouldn't have regretted going.
Yeah.
I think more intensive, the MI thing or GIT thing was really just a 12-month program at that point in time. So it was like, look, you're going to go to Hollywood for 12 months and play a lot of guitar, which I did. It just, a lot of it was not necessarily like, boy, this school is difficult to pass. It wasn't at the time. They had a curriculum that you basically just had to go into your private teacher, and you had to fulfill a certain amount of hours at the school, but that was as easy as going up there and clocking that you were in and going back to your apartment and doing whatever you wanted and then going back and clocking out.
Yeah.
But I did play guitar a lot. I mean, I remember a long stretch of playing 8 hours a day during that time. And so I definitely was playing a ton of guitar.
Yeah. When did you move away from the Beretta?
So that happened. TJ Helmrich was out there and made friends with Brett Garcid, who is not as well known here in the States, but he had been playing for John Farnham in Australia, which is a huge, huge gig. And then he had come over to play with Nelson.
Oh, yeah.
So you have to remember at this point in time, that was, they were on the charts. Like,
oh, yeah.
Nelson went out. So I was hanging out. I was an absolute nobody kid, but I was hanging out with Brett, who was like a guy who had like a number one hit.
Okay.
And not only that, but is an amazing player. I mean, Brett Garcid's an amazing guitar player, and able to jam with those guys. And so Brett was parting with, I had decided I needed to up my game from the Beretta, especially this. Yeah. I mean, I wanted something like more, I guess, next level up. And so he had a modified Phil Collin Jackson that he had used with Nelson.
Uh-huh.
And he sold me that guitar.
Okay.
And so I ended up, that was kind of guitar number three for me that went for quite a while as well.
Okay.
Through a lot of that 70 students a week period. Even.
Yeah. Wow. All right. And when did you make the break to Gibsons?
So yeah, it's, you know, it took a long time, man. I'd say my next main guitar that I bought that went away pretty quickly was a Brian Moore, because I brought it on. At this point in time, I was starting to get bigger work. The gigs got better locally in Chicago, and I was doing a session for Jim Peterick, who founded Survivor in the Eyes of March.
Yeah.
And he kind of called out the sound of it, and he said, you know, well, why do you have that guitar? And so I ended up kind of getting a parts guitar Tele that I really liked that became my main guitar. And I tried moving to Strat from there for a while, but didn't gravitate towards it.
Yeah.
And when I came out to New York, it was to do a piece, theater piece about Janis Joplin, where I was in the onstage band. It's called Love Janis.
Yeah.
And so I showed up with this parts guitar Tele for that. And everybody was like, man, Big Brother and the Holding Company, those guys were SGs. Yeah. So I was like, right, I'll get an SG. So got an SG, and I gigged with that. We did a lot of shows of that. Like the director, I think after running it here for 2 years, 8 shows a week locally, yeah, in New York City, sent me out to regional theaters to go do it. And
oh, wow.
So I'd go sit down for cities in 6 weeks and play that show. So after getting done using the SG for so long, I decided to finally like give the Les Paul a go. I was like, now I guess at this point in time, like 32, like it took me long enough. And then I got literally the gold top that you see me with all the time.
Okay.
And that has really turned into my main guitar in life.
Yeah, what year is
in
that?
In fact, I'm about to go pick it up today. I just had a refret done
on
it with Matt at 30th Street Guitars.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm right about to go grab that. But that turned me into a Les Paul guy. And honestly, I do go back and dabble with the other stuff. I'm glad I have a little bit of a Floyd Rose background and a little bit of a single coil background. But the Les Paul has definitely become the instrument of choice for me, for sure.
Yeah. What year is that gold top?
You know, I'm so bad with that serial number thing, but I think it's a 2002.
Oh, okay. So it's a relatively...
But it's an R7, but honestly, you'd look at it and you'd think it's a 57. It's got so much wear on it. Like,
yeah,
people,
yeah,
like, see it and they assume it's, like, a vintage. Like, wow, cool. Like, that's, you know, you got a 57. Like, no. It's like, I just beat the crap out of it. I've played it an awful lot. But, I mean, since then, the Les Paul obsession began, and... Also, I have that Trans-Siberian Orchestra gig that I do,
yeah,
and that is kind of tempting because you can play a lot of fun guitars to look at, and you've got the big budget and the tech, and so I end up taking a lot of guitars out on that are just kind of really a fun part of the collection. Like, I did go back and get some Floyd Rose stuff, like the Satch Chrome Boy, I play,
sure,
on that.
Yeah.
But I also have some really interesting guitars on there. Like, I play a reworked Steinberger, which was basically, now I'm going to forget the model number, but GM5TA, I think, or something like that.
Okay.
But Headless USA, I worked with Headless USA on that. They had a damn near mint body and neck, and the only thing that needs to be reworked on those is the trans trim, because they're not functional after years. They
okay.
kind of eroded. So they rebuilt the trans trim, and so I have that guitar, which is kind of interesting to take out there. I have a Gibson Modern V, of which I don't even know how many. They didn't make very many of those at all. That was that kind of Roswell Rhodes
looking.
Yeah,
of course.
And actually, a great sounding guitar, like shockingly, because you wouldn't think so with the body style and whatnot, but that's a great sounding guitar. I have, let's see, a Gibson Anniversary, 50th Anniversary V, that they only made 500 of those, and I have number 500 out with them on that. So I've ended up with some interesting pieces over the years, as far as, you know, the vintage guitar thing goes. I have an interesting collection, and then I have stuff that I think will age well in terms of that, where when I joined Whitesnake, I kind of independently decided I'm going to have new guitars made for this gig. Yeah, so I went to Gibson and I said, I have this idea of putting like a Whitesnake medallion in the body. So I went to a mint and I had them make those medallions to like off the original Whitesnake logo, embed them in the body. And then they put a snake stencil on the top. So I have a white and black one and a gold and black one.
Yeah.
That are really cool. And then Fender was cool enough to do the same.
Oh, wow.
Because we were doing the Purple tour at the time.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, you know, maybe I'll end up playing some Strat. And then this smaller company out of Arizona, Atomic Guitars, basically independently came up with this idea of like, look, why don't we do this Swarovski crystal like top, all purple for the Purple tour.
Yeah.
We'll put a gold WS on there. And that ended up, they've made a few guitars for me, one for TSO that was an Explorer, and one from when I was in the Broadway show Rock of Ages that had the fictitious logo on it, Arsenal, of the band that we were fictitiously a part of.
Uh-huh.
And this one turned out to be the gem of the bunch, actually. It's a really great sounding guitar as well. There are certain ones that like pop along where you're like, I'm really shocked at how great this thing sounds, because you think with the crystals and everything, maybe it would kind of battle with the tone of it, but it's a great sound. So anyway, I think those might age well in terms of collection, because they're basically one of a kind.
Yeah.
I know there's some Whitesnake tribute acts that have kind of mimicked them.
Oh, really?
Where they've sort of made their own versions of them and whatnot. Which is obviously very flattering that they would kind of pull from that. But it also shows that they made an impact, and that decision to have guitars made for the Whitesnake gig made an impact on people.
Yeah. When you got the Janus theater gig, how did that come about? Like, I mean, most guitarists don't go to theater gigs.
I mean, it was pretty rocking, man. It was theater, but it was like rock, and we were loud.
Yeah.
And we were on stage, and we were pretty much right in everybody's face with that stuff. So that was really Kathy Richardson I was playing with locally. Kathy sings for Jefferson Starship
with
these
Jude
days.
Gold.
So I had worked my way up to playing locally with her, which is part of the process locally in Chicago. She was doing great. She had her own records out and was selling a ton of them, and you'd play some covers, but mainly her music, and she had a big draw. So that was kind of where things locally were first picking up for me, and that's what brought me on Jim Peterick's radar from Survivor, because Kathy would hire the players locally, and then he would say, yeah, why don't you come in and do some sessions, and he put me in his World Stage Band, which is something where you're basically a house band, and then he would have his friends and guests come in, and you would back them up.
Right on.
So here I am, this local guy in Chicago. I was probably about, I don't know, 27, and I got to start backing up like Kevin Cronin from REO Speedwagon, Don Barnes from 38 Special, Alan Parsons, Rick Emmett from Triumph, Kip Winger. And it wasn't just like the 80s-ish thing, too. It was a lot of like, you know, Anthony Gomes playing his blues stuff with him. So Jim is a real open-minded guy, too, and it would be one of the people that was on the gig every year was the Night Ranger drummer, Kelly Kagi.
Oh, sure.
So we'd play the Night Ranger songs, and so you can see that those kind of two parallel roads happened at the same time. I was out coming to New York to do Love Janis, but still flying back to Chicago to play Jim's World Stage gigs.
Wow.
And that allowed Kelly, when there was an availability, what happened there between Jeff Watson and myself, Reb Beach did the gig for a year.
Yeah.
Was playing with Night Ranger. So I found out Jeff wasn't with them, and I kind of told Kelly, you should have called me. And,
and
he said, well, Reb needs to go back to Whitesnake. You can see how small the scene is here. So he said, you know, I'll keep you in mind. And next thing I knew, like a week or two later, the phone was ringing, and Kelly was asking me if I was available to do a show with them that Reb needed to play with Winger on. And so that was sort of my audition, really, for Night Ranger, was going to play a gig with them. There was no... That's the way it really works, especially in a fly date scene like bands don't really want to fly some guy in and rehearse with them for a week. They just want some guy to learn it and come in and do the gig. And
yeah, yeah.
not have to go through that rigmarole. So that was Kelly's big preach to them, and that's something I've always been really big on, is being a homework guy, like being really prepped.
Sure, sure.
So I came in for those Peter gigs, like knowing like 36 songs. Those were like monster shows. Yeah, we would just play forever. I mean, it was like 3-4 hour kind of stuff. And so Kelly said to them, I know this guy from Peter Expand, and he preps, and he comes in, he gets off the plane, no rehearsal, and he plays these gigs down, and they went like, all right, let's use him. Let's do it. So that was, that was the entrance to Night Ranger.
Wow. And what was it like working with Brad?
Great, man. Had a great time with Brad Gillis. I mean, you know, great big brother, little brother thing going on. And I was really green in the big picture. I mean, I had been making a living with my guitar, but I'd never really landed anything where people cared about who the guitar player was. Like between working with Love Janice, I had gone out with Big Brother and the Holding Company. The music director was Sam Andrew.
Wow.
So I was doing that type of stuff. And then one of my subs played with the Turtles and needed a replacement there. So wow. I worked with the Turtles for like 4 years doing like Happy Together and stuff. So stuff that people wouldn't necessarily expect out of like the Whitesnake guitar player or whatever, right? So strange path there, but joining Night Ranger was really, I think, the first time where people kind of cared. You're taking over, you're filling in the shoes, whereas like Jeff Watson, obviously, you know, innovative time period and a highly respected name in guitar. So for me to hop in there was the first time that really brought a lot of attention and heat on me in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Had you already been doing the 8-finger tapping thing?
Yeah, that was something that, because of TJ Helmrich, I think TJ probably just wanted to practice during my lessons, and he was showing me that stuff when I was like, 13, 14 years old, when I probably should have just been working on playing eighth notes. But I was working on the tapping thing at a young age, and so luckily that came full circle, because honestly, there was that whole time period that occurred for me with launching out as a pro where the 90s happened, and you weren't breaking out 8-finger technique on a single thing, man. Otherwise, like, nobody wanted to ever work with you again. So I kind of kept my chops together with that stuff. I was making fusion-y records. My first solo albums really kind of kept me on that game.
Yeah. And how did you make the transition from Night Ranger to Whitesnake?
That was just more or less at that time I had landed Rock of Ages on Broadway, and that came about through subbing on Pit Stuff here in New York City. I have a friend a couple blocks from here who's more of a like dedicated, actual legitimate pit musician, which I am not. I mean, I was like, dude, he asked me if I wanted to sub for him. I'm like, isn't that like sight reading, like on the spot? And he was like, no, we get you the book, you learn it, we'll give you audio. I thought, all right, I can do that because I'll prep my ass off.
Yeah.
And I did. So I just started subbing for him on whatever shows he was going in on. And that was more of just like a self-improvement kind of thing, because I wasn't working on reading for most of my gigs. And I thought, this is like an opportunity to better that a bit. And you never know, maybe I'll want to do that when I'm older, like playing the pits or whatever. And then what ended up happening is the keyboard player from one of those shows became the music supervisor for Rock of Ages. He got hired, and he was like, yeah, I remember this guy that was like, had long hair, was kind of a rocker guy subbing. And so I got hired for Rock of Ages even before they knew I was in Night Ranger. And then I just said, well, actually, I'm playing with Night Ranger now too. And their song was in the show. Okay. And oddly enough, so was Whitesnakes. So here I go again. But the way that happened is, so I had those two gigs kind of coinciding, and I'd gotten Trans-Siberian Orchestra. But it looked like Rock of Ages was going to close, and I was kind of like, thinking, just looking for like the next thing. And it just so happened that Doug Aldrich was stepping away from the band, and all I really wanted to do was audition. But I was such an early bird gets the worm guy with that. I just got right on it and started reaching out via email. And initially, I of course passed those to Reb because we knew each other now, right? We'd been on the bills together, Winger and Night Ranger, and I had done the Night Ranger thing. And I just kind of made the mistake of sending him pre-existing stuff. I was sending him pre-existing Night Ranger videos, et cetera, to send to David Carriel.
Sure, sure.
And I think David maybe watched a minute of one of those and went like, nah, like, you know, this isn't the guy. But luckily what had happened is when I was touring with Night Ranger, I'd also made a friendship with Phil Carson, who manages Foreigner, because he managed Dee Snider. Dee Snider came into the cast at Rock of Ages.
Oh, okay.
So when we went on tour, it was Night Ranger, Foreigner, Journey, and Mick Jones, went down, basically. Yeah. And Phil had me come in on like a day's notice and fill in Farmer for Mick Jones. So I had kind of done them a solid and like, you know, get like hopping in there and kind of saving the that particular situation. Wow. So in my thinking of like, come on, man, I got to be, well, I was kind of mad that I wasn't going to get an audition. And yeah. I thought I should be able to get an audition for Whitesnake. And Phil Carson came to mind as like a British guy. I thought, I bet he knows David. Yeah. And sure enough, I asked Phil and he said, sure, I'll take care of that. And he emailed David and it turned out to be like right as David was coming out of meditation about this whole thing about you know, please let the universe bring me a guitarist and bing, you know, email comes across from Phil Carson saying, I highly advise you take a look at this guy. You know, he's really good and whatever, kind of talked my way into getting an audition through Phil and got that audition. And then obviously that worked out. David and I did clicked right away. Once once I got out there for the audition, it was just something that it felt right. And I think I was just offered that a lot of just, I think my eagerness to be there.
Yeah.
So that the early bird gets the worm kind of thing. And that wasn't necessarily driven by me not being happy with Night Ranger. Some people think that, but it was just really driven by me kind of looking for that next step or what was going to be new or different, especially with Rock of Ages looking like it was going to close after 6 years and thinking like, you know, might need something different here.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you a Marshall person? What kind of amps have you been using?
Yeah, I'm a Marshall guy, like as far as fly dates go. And then with Whitesnake, I was using Friedman.
Oh, yeah.
And then the other gigs I do are modeling stuff. I mean, with TSO, we're Fractal. Uh-huh. And when I landed the Cher situation, that was something where the guitarist was using a big rig. But we were going to be going to Australia. So they were like, dude, what can you do as far as like whittling this down? And I said, well, I mean, if you get me an AB box up here, I can pretty much take his rig and take a Fractal and try and program in the, that was an interesting moment because I've never had to use a Fractal in that sense. Normally you just dial it up and you dial up a sound you like for a gig, but to have to replicate or duplicate what somebody else's rig was doing was an interesting challenge for that. So I ended up using that with Cher. And yeah, I mean, just kind of like, yeah, I think there's a certain like rig for every gig that makes sense. TSO, you can't, the stage is so wide and you're all over the place. It's not the normal thing where you're in front of your amp and you go up to your mic to sing backing vocals. No, it's just like you've got the width of the arena and you're going to all those spots and running around and pyro's going off. So they don't have amps on stage. Yeah. And even if I did use an amp, to me, that's the whole point of using an amp. If you have it on stage and you're hitting your pickups again and getting some of those even order harmonics, that's what really brings out the tone of the amp. There's something to be said for cranking it, but it's never been the full story for me. I think it's more about like it hitting your guitar and being able to get sustained with less gain.
Sure.
So with TSO, what I do is because we're Fractal is use a lot of sustainers. So it becomes like alternate way. I guess we'd probably call fake tone in a lot of ways. Like you're looking to emulate the feedback. Yeah. That would be like what you would get off an amp. But if you're able to do it, dude, I mean, you got to find workarounds on gigs. If you don't have an amp up there and you're holding a power cord and it's dying. So, I mean, one of the things I found with the modeling thing that when you go high gain, it's often really noisy. So then you end up gating. And then what happens is you don't have the sustain anyway.
Yeah.
So for me, the sustainers were the workaround with that. Yeah. And still to this day, I mean, I just finished a tour with them.
Yeah.
Use that in that situation because I think it works.
Are you using in-ears when you're doing that?
Yeah.
And definitely. How are your ears? How do they hold up with the in-ears?
I mean, I have to crank my in-ears to be
Yeah, I know. That's the problem.
Yeah. So, I mean, I notice I experience, I definitely have some hearing loss for sure. And I experience on the TSO tour a lot of short-term hearing loss too.
Yeah.
Like we'll play two shows that day and at the end of the night we're in the signing line and everybody's voices to me just sounds like, I can't tell what you're saying to me. The fans are blah, 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 and I'm going, oh my gosh. But It doesn't linger. It's not like full time. It's not long term hearing loss. Sure. But I have experienced some of that for sure.
Yeah. And are those bus tours?
Yeah, that is almost exclusively bus. We had one moment where the routing took us from Atlanta to Albany. That might have been bus, but we were on the Today Show between. So what we did was fly to New York City. On the 2 days off, we flew the first day. The second morning, woke up, did the Today Show, hopped on our buses, and drove up to Albany.
And so your new album, I should bring it up since that's what we're here for.
That's what we're here for, right? I know.
It's From the Fade, right?
Yeah.
And who's singing?
So Girish Pradhan, who's a great hard rock / metal singer from India, and he kind of found a little bit of a viral situation this year on America's Got Talent.
Oh, okay.
He was doing these videos that were, this is a sound check where he'd do these big screams in the mic, and it kind of went viral online, and the people at America's Got Talent saw it and brought his band over, Girish and the Chronicles, to compete on America's Got Talent, and they did well. They did like a metal cover of an Adele song and won. And then they had another appearance where they covered another artist, I can't remember who, and did really well but didn't win. But he, because of that, found some increased fame in the U.S. this year. But the lineup is essentially like well-known classic rock guys. It's Vinny Appice on drums, Tony Franklin on bass, Derek Sherinian on keys. And then my friend Jeff Scott Soto does the backing vocals on all these records, mainly just due to our friendship and the fact that he fronts a million other projects and doesn't necessarily need to front this one.
Were you ever a fan of Rick Derringer? You're too young, but...
No, absolutely. I mean, absolutely.
And does Vinny ever talk about playing with Rick?
No, I mean, Vinny is just kind of like a real no-nonsense guy. When we first started this, like, I didn't even know Vinny. I'd never met Vinny. I'd worked with one project on Tony Franklin, with Tony Franklin. And so he was the first guy. I said, man, you know, you sound great. I'm thinking of forming a more rock thing. Because what happened to me is I developed a bit of a name through doing Night Ranger and Whitesnake and Rock of Ages and TSO, and the fans were going back to my early solo records and they're like, what the hell is this? It was like fusion, kind of rock fusion, proggy, and I had made this fingerstyle acoustic CD, and like, I mean, they were like, where's the rock? I mean, so I decided it was something I wanted to do anyway. Like, I'd always wanted, I knew I was going to do that at some point in time. So hence the Joel Hoekstra's 13 label as opposed to Joel Hoekstra. I wanted a difference between them. These don't sound like guitar player solo records. Yeah. There's no like long extended guitar solos, and I think there's good guitar work on it, but for me it was an opportunity to take more or less these situations that I was in with these bands, but be the person that could do all the writing, not just write the guitar riffs, but write the vocal melodies and the lyrics and everything. So that's why this is really my baby, is it gives me an opportunity to write the songs and then play the way I want to play, oversee the mix, oversee the artwork. They're more or less made as, I suppose, for like an artistic outlet for me, more so than a money-making endeavor. It's not like doing a gig for me. It's something that's part of, it always sounds self-important when I say it, but legacy, because I think at the end of my career, I want to be known more as more than just a guy who had cool gigs.
You're way too young to be talking about the end of your career.
The three solo albums and having four of now, this is the fourth Joel Hoekstra's 13 album. To me, that's important. I think, you know, making your own music that's always been important to me. That's usually everybody's dream when they're young. They're not necessarily thinking about what gig they're going to land. They're thinking about like making it big in their own thing, which hasn't necessarily been the path for me. I mean, this wouldn't pay the bills. But for me to get it out is important to me as an artist.
Yeah. Are you going to tour it?
I mean, we've done one gig in support of the first one, Dying to Live, on the Monsters of Rock cruise. Logistically, I'd lose my ass. I mean, if I had to pay the band, the hotels, the travel, and get it out there, the backdrop, kind of lay it out there, I'm in a situation living in New York City with two kids, sending them through their private schools and whatnot. And it's like, dude, I need to get down to like what's actually going to pay the bills here too. And when I make my own music, I mean, that would be great. I would love to have the opportunity to do it, and it would be a lot of fun. but I don't see that ever becoming financially successful for me.
Yeah.
I think it's something that for me, thankfully, Frontiers is willing to give me the artistic outlet, and not to mention artistic freedom. I should give them a shout on it. They've been super cool, man. Every one of these records I've made, they've just let me do my thing.
Right.
Like, just record what you want. And so I just record it and turn it in, and they've not balked at any of it. And they could have on this one, because it got a little heavier, took a little veer more towards the metal side on this one. Obviously, the melody is still there and whatnot, but I think I was, at the time of putting this album together, working with Accept, I was filling in with them, and so I was learning all these metal riffs, and then when I went to go write songs, I just started playing all these metal riffs, man, and I was like, well, okay, I guess, you know, the new record, we'll see how it goes. And I just thought, look, if I can write hooky melodies to this stuff, then it's still going to be cool.
Absolutely. No, it sounds fantastic.
Thanks, man. Appreciate
of course. Is that your gig right now, playing with this app?
I mean, I'm kind of all over the place in terms of, like, what I'm doing. I like, all the way from teaching virtual lessons to playing acoustic duo stuff with Hoekstra Gibbs, which is something that I'm out with, to still taking the Rock of Ages stuff and playing the full-length versions of those songs with Broadway's Rock of Ages band.
Wow.
I have two other Frontiers things that I'm a part of.
Wow.
Revolution Saints, which is with Dean Castronovo from Journey.
I just
finished tracking that new record, and that's in the mix, kind of prepping for the videos and whatnot stage.
Wow.
And another project called Iconic, which is with my Whitesnake bandmate, Tommy Aldridge, also Marco Mendoza, previously of Whitesnake on bass, and Michael Sweet on guitar from Striper. We share the guitar duties, and then Nathan James, great vocalist from the UK, fronting that and singing. Those two albums, as far as recording, are kind of what's next. Been doing some producing, just produced a brand new artist, Austin Starr, and that record is being quite well received for a brand new artist. And that was interesting, because different generation, and kind of looking for more of, like, anywhere from emo influenced stuff to the pretty reckless kind of influenced stuff. And me putting my, I guess, inevitably my classic rock roots in there, ended up landing in the Frontiers label as well. That's doing quite well. And but no shred on that. No no shredding guitars, but just, like, good guitar work.
And how, so do you have a home studio?
I do, just kind of like real, you know, meat and potatoes, man, basic stuff. Like, I'm doing, the typical thing I get a call for is to play guest solos on people's records. People want, you know, hey, this album features a solo from Joel Hoekstra from Whitesnake track. So you get a lot of that. I'm doing one today, as a matter of fact, but until I go down and pick up my gold top with the refret, which I'm excited to get it back. And then tomorrow I'll do another one of those, and I'm prepping to go in to Guitar World and do some video stuff for them on Wednesday. And so I just kind of, my MO is to stay busy musically, and that's like every day. So I don't really believe in days off. I just kind of work and then see where it all takes me.
Yeah. How old are your kids?
They are 13 and 10.
Oh, the talkback ages.
No, they're cool.
Oh, good.
They're cool. It's a pretty good. Maybe almost 14 and 10.
Okay.
My boy's getting, it's a pretty good age. Not quite old enough to be like, I hate my dad, but like, kind of old enough to be self-sufficient.
Sure.
You know, diapers are gone.
Does he play baseball?
Never thought you'd see that, for the diapers are gone, right?
Does he play baseball?
He does. Yeah, he plays baseball. He jams a little bit on guitar too, but it's just kind of like I've showed him riffs, and he just plays like song bits. And but classical piano is kind of the route I went with the kids.
Very good.
So every night we just get together, and I'm not one of these like musicians trying to drive their kids to the point of insanity with it. We just hit it a little bit each night. We stay consistent. 10-15 minutes, something like that.
Right.
And they've gotten quite good. They've each been playing since they were six.
Wow. Yeah, that's great. That's excellent. And what do you do? I mean, apart from, you have the kids. What do you do for fun?
Really basic stuff, man. Escape music, usually, because I work with music a lot. So I'm just like movies, sports, kind of real basic, normal dude on the outside of it all. And, you know, when people ask me, like, what are you listening to lately? It's like, man, it's always just like whatever I'm working on. Are you kidding me? I don't really go and listen to anything with that designated purpose ever.
Yeah. Yeah. Any plans to tour with any of these bands anytime soon?
You never know what'll take off with that. I mean, I'm open to all of it. There's definitely been attempts to get all of that off the ground. The Joel Oakeshott 13 is probably the most challenging for me just because I've never really been like a leader in that regard. Like, I've never really had to put together my own thing and been the guy that's going to pay the bills and take it out. Yeah. And usually when you're that guy, you're the guy that's going to lose your money at first, you know? And and I just don't know if at this stage of the game I can warrant that. But yeah, artistically speaking, I would love it.
Yeah. Are you going to NAMM?
I am. I'm going to NAMM. I had a couple of my early things that I had planned this year that were going to keep me going from NAMM get rescheduled. So I'm gonna head out there and I'm gonna play a jam night out there that I'll be a part of.
Yeah.
Which has a long, very long list of
everybody,
you know, known people in the scene and whatnot. So looking forward to seeing everybody and jamming with everybody.
Yep. Are you gonna make any appearances at the booths or no?
You know, I haven't even really let the companies know. Okay. So I doubtful. I'm terrible that way. I mean, I'd probably go out and like just kind of work the floor, walk the floor a little bit and hang out. I mean, you know how it goes at NAMM, man. You always end up seeing somebody and meeting somebody. Yeah. It's like you find it hard to like walk there really at first. You go into the hall and it's like, I think there was a time last year where I was standing in one spot for like an hour or
exactly.
something like that.
And I can only imagine you getting mobbed over there.
It's one of the rare places that I feel like I'm famous a bit, you know, like, where I'm like, I mean, I don't feel that way the majority of my life. Like if I'm going into an airport or something like that, I'll get recognized here and there, but not too often. A couple, you know, here and there locally. It does happen, but like not enough that I would ever describe myself as truly being famous. It's just kind of maybe in our scene.
Yeah.
People would know who I am. So when I go to NAMM, it's one of the rare times where I actually feel like, wow, people actually know who the hell I am. And it's always still shocking to me.
Excellent. Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, Joel. I appreciate your time.
Likewise, man. Thanks. I really appreciate it.
I hope I get to be one of the people at NAMM that that runs into you.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd love that.
Right on. Thank you, Joel.
Thanks so much for everything. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Have Guitar Will Travel. You can catch up on all the things I'm doing at thedeadlies.com. And I'm on all the social media platforms as well. And please support Vintage Guitar and all the wonderful things they do, because they do many, many wonderful things for us guitar players. Thanks. Please subscribe. Please tell a friend. And I'll see you guys next week. Bye, guys.